Not a con.
Places it on an imaging surface of some sort, be it film, be it digital, be it very strange forms of digital. The imaging surface then somehow picks up the light, records it in some format, and stuffs it away in some storage medium and prepares to do the same thing again. This is just the basics of how a camera works. Okay. So now I'm going to jump through various settings and terminology that matter when you're flying a camera, because if you don't have these right, any conversation about photography will fly right over your head and you'll be going, huh? Okay, ISO. ISO actually stands for International Standards Organization. However, in the vernacular of flying cameras, it actually refers to how fast a imaging surface captures light, which is to say how sensitive it is, or in the case of digital image surface, what the gain is. The higher the number, the more sensitive the surface is. So a film speed of 100 is much less sensitive to light than a film speed of 1600, which is why when you're shooting for dark situations or indoor situations, or anything where you aren't going to have a lot of light to work with, you typically choose a higher ISO. Not always, but typically. There are reasons not to. Proportionally, the higher your ISO setting goes, the grainier your image will become. Bad both ways. This may or may not matter, but so this is a blow up of a very small section of an image I shot in my backyard at setting at 100. Roughly the same section at 3200. And this projector is cleaning it up. Yes, officially. What you're supposed to be able to see, which is impossible to see in this image, because the projector is resampling this and smoothing out the graininess, is that this image has a whole lot more hotspots inside of it. And if I flip between them, you might be able to get a sense of it. It's rather hard to tell, but on lower end cameras, say what most people who are not out of their minds would choose to use. Most lower-end cameras, in fact, don't go above an ISO setting of 400. They might get up to 800, maybe 1600. Very maybe there. And they get really grainy when you get to, they get very grainy when you get to that level of sensitivity. This is because in the digital realm, you have a knob marked gain and you just essentially are turning it up. And in the process, you pick up more random noise. So, obviously, based on what I've said, if you're having to choose a given ISO to work at, choose the lowest one you can get away with, given the rest of the conditions that you're going to be shooting around. Typical automatic modes range 100 to 400 on a given camera. Depending on your camera, it can get much, much higher. And occasionally it can get lower, but not as often. Okay, next to the three settings, aperture. There's a iris that actually lives inside either the lens or your camera body, or if you can't separate. Gabe, have you pulled out tactical overkill yet? Yes. That has a significantly larger aperture than anything I can play with. Okay. Charging right along. There's an iris that lives inside the camera at some stage. This iris controls how much light gets through the lens to the imaging surface. This is also called the f-stop. This is because it's a fractional value. You specify the The aperture setting is specified as an F, for example, F3.5, which actually should be thought of as F1 over 3.5. This is why, as you increase this number, there is less light getting through the lens. And it's actually a fractional value of how much light that possibly could get through a lens that size, actually making it to the imaging surface. Like I said, F1.8 is a wider iris setting than an F3.5 because, well, 1 over 1.8 is a larger number than 1 over 3.5. I should point out that these numbers, 1.8, 3.5, they aren't randomly chosen, though it may feel like it. You will run into them remarkably often. They are chosen very specifically for a reason I'll be getting into in a minute. Sure, bring those up. Okay, let's have fun. So, this is the camera I tend to use. Actually, let's just do it this way. He and I have the same cameras, same camera body, but we have entirely different sets of lenses. This is a not half bad lens, but it only goes to f3.5. This one's f-stop minimum is 4. What's that?
2.8.
Here, put them right next to each other. There's a little bit of difference in the amount of lens there.
And this is 1.8.
Yes.
You see this, the same focal length, the same length lens. This is 2.8, this is 1.8.
So if you want a lens which has a low f-stop, which means, which I'll be getting to, because of course this is one of those wonderful things where you have to have all of this in your head before it makes sense. So I do apologize, there is no logical order. You just have to absorb it all, and then it makes sense. If you have a lens with a lower f-stop, you can absorb more light. If you can absorb more light, you can use, well, a lower ISO setting, which means you clearer images. The f-stop has another interesting function is, as the aperture becomes wider, the depth of field of whatever you're focused on gets narrower, which I'm about to show you because it's pretty easy. This is f3.5. This is actually, I shot this image the other day with this camera. No big deal. If you look in the foreground, it's horribly blurred out. It's clear about halfway, so I think I actually had it focused here. That is the actual focal point. And then it gets blurry in the background again, but since it's so far away, it's rather hard to see it. I turned up the aperture. So how do you want to call it, guys? It gets really annoying. That would be an accurate description. It's f22. Now, all the stuff in the foreground is a much clearer focus, but it's still fuzzy. But you have an in-focus distance from all the way from here to here. This is actually a tractor that's sitting in the backyard. That's actually the steering column. If you have never seen a tractor like that, I have pictures if you want to see.
The picture of the kitten in the oral scene at CNS is a very good demonstration of that also.
How wonderful! I never thought of that. Thank you, Bunsen. I may have nightmares now. Right. Okay. More terminology. Designed to confuse. You will hear the term used faster in numbers of context, all entirely independently referring to different things. This is designed to confuse people who haven't heard it before, as best I can tell. A lens that is referred to as faster has a lower numbered f-stop. So the two lenses Gabe just had in here would be considered faster than the two lenses I have, though it has absolutely nothing to do with shutter speed, which is what we will be talking about next, which is the only thing I have in here actually measured in seconds, as in time. The reason it's called faster is since it has a lower f-stop, you can use a faster shutter speed for the same image given all other parameters. So, you just saw the depth of field effect. This is really useful in portrait work, or if you want to see the subject and you don't want to see the subject's surroundings.
So is that why in like sporting events you see the photographers with the giant lenses?
Yes. Because they want to be able to see, okay, there's two reasons for this. One, they want to be able to sit 50 yards away from whatever's going on and get a close-up of the guy's chest and head, and that's it.
Yeah.
So you need a long lens to do that. In this sense, a telephoto lens. Often zoom, because there's little sense nowadays in not bothering with the zoom, but we can get into lens terminology in a bit. But they also need an incredibly wide f-stop on it, because they not only need to be able to get from a long distance a close-up shot, but they also only want to see the guy. They don't want to see the audience behind him. So, that said, that's the Rose Garden at Michigan State University. The rose in the foreground is actually what I'm focused on. The f-stop is open to 3.5, which is the maximum. Ouch. The maximum that my lens can do. The background blurs out. It was, in fact, other roses back there, but you can't see it because I'm focused on it and I'm close enough that the depth of field is that long. And everything else behind it blurs out and you can get this really cool effect. You can do this with essentially any subject you want. You most often done with face portrait work. Everybody does that with portrait work. And they are worse because they usually have you sit behind a background, which is blurry to start with, and then they use the f-stop to blur it out more, so you got this disembodied face hanging in this foggy mess behind it. Works great if that's the goal you're going for. Shutter speed. Okay, now we get to the single thing, which is actually referred to in seconds. This is how long a shutter, which is a chunk of metal, plastic, or something else, sometimes purely electronic, that determines how long the imaging surface is actually capturing light. Yet again, another fractional value. Often they won't bother putting the top half of the fraction there because it's assumed. Everybody knows that nobody would want a shutter open for more than 1 second. Typical person. Somebody who's not trained, somebody who doesn't spend a lot of time but doesn't shake unnecessarily, needs to be shooting a picture handheld of 1/60th of a second or faster, because otherwise you shake and it blurs. Unless, of course, you in fact want the image to blur, which is an entirely artistic possibility and I am unqualified to speak on. The shorter shutter speeds mean you can bring otherwise in motion objects to a complete stop and results in really interesting things. I had to go digging through my archive. I could not find anything moving fast enough yesterday in my backyard to warrant this. So this is a very slow shutter speed of a fountain where I work. You see how the water sort of blurs together? That's because it was shot over a course of almost a quarter second. However, when it was shot in 1/500th of a second, there are drops of water there that have frozen the air. Choose how you want to take the picture. This is one of the many settings you can play with. Okay, here's where it gets fun. Just covered those three settings. Those three settings are important because you have to balance all three of them together to get the effect you are hunting for. Given a specific environment of lighting, for instance, this one, you're going to be able to set up a shot at a certain ISO, at a certain shutter speed, at a certain f-stop. Now, this is for average lighting. Say you want to turn it into a stop-motion shot. You want a faster shutter speed. You're going to have to give somewhere. You're either going to have to turn your ISO up or you're going to have to turn your aperture up. Same rules apply. If you want to blur an image, you're going to have to turn down your ISO, or you're going to have to make your aperture crank down. You have to balance all three of these elements together, and when you balance them, you can come up with the actual picture that you intended to take. And where I was going before, the choices of f-stops are very specifically chosen such that you can move one f-stop and double or half your shutter exposure time. So the typical f-stops that you will find in the camera are designed so that if you double your shutter time, you can, or excuse me, if you double your exposure time, you have to move down one f-stop, and the amount of light that actually makes it to the imaging surface stays the same. This was really useful 30 years ago, or even 20 years ago, when everything didn't come with a light meter. Light meters! Light meters make it possible for me to take decent photographs. I am backing up. My only experience with photographs is spending the last 2 years running around with too much camera for my own good, shooting pictures of anything that got in my way. I've learned this all the hard way. I read a lot of theory. I read a lot of books. It didn't help. Playing with a camera with manual settings for 2 years, that helped. Light meter. Okay. It measures the amount of light entering the camera and landing on the imaging surface, usually without engaging the imaging surface itself. That varies based on modern cameras, but it's a detail we don't have to worry about. You point it at an object or a scene, it measures the amount of light coming in, and then it takes a solid guess at what settings the camera should be at. And then modern cameras let you change them, because you say, no, I disagree. This is how automatic mode works on most digital cameras. You point it at the scene, you pull the shutter release, it looks at the scene, it figures out, here are the settings that will end up with X amount of light actually hitting the imaging surface. Okay, I'm gonna shoot those. What I can do, and what most even moderate level cameras can do, is I can point it at a scene, half pull the shutter, it takes a guess, figures out what it believes is the right amount of imaging on it, right amount of light to hit the imaging surface, and then I can adjust it up and down for the amount of light, or I can adjust the balance of the ISO, the aperture, and the shutter speed. This is true of most mid-range cameras. I'm going to be honest, I only use Canon hardware, so I can't tell you anything about Nikon. I can't tell you anything about any of the other companies. And I use SLRs because I was young and stupid and I picked up a big camera when I could. And it was worth it because I learned a lot the hard way. Okay, charging right along. Everybody advertises their zoom numbers. Everybody loves talking about their 100x digital zoom. I'd stay away from it. Stay as far away from it as you possibly can. Optical zoom actually plays with image with optical elements before it hits your imaging surface. Your imaging surface is size of postage stamp in most cameras. In mine, it's the size of a big postage stamp. Optical zoom, we run optics back and forth, sets up a different focal length on the lens, which allows you to put a different angle coming in and out of the lens onto the imaging surface. Digital zoom. Let's take your optical sensor. Let's take the imaging sensor. Let's cut a square smaller out of the middle of it and then scale it up to the full size of the image that everybody was expecting. That's digital zoom. C statement. Don't do this. If you can, shut it off. It's better for everybody. This is the insert Nick Farr segment of today's program, who will not be attending this evening. I don't have one, but I hear camera phones are becoming very popular. Okay, everybody with a camera phone, pull it out right now and shoot a picture of me. Oh, wow! Shocking! Either nobody's listening to me at all and you've all fallen asleep instantly, or nobody here has a camera phone. Okay, we got one! We got one! Camera phones. You can get good pictures out of a camera phone. It is in fact possible. Be 4 foot away from your subject in blazing daylight. They work great! In all seriousness, they actually work great in that situation. In any other situation, you're gonna get lucky, maybe. And while I'm talking about this, true with every camera system out there. More light, better. The more light you can put in an area, the happier you will be taking photos inside of it. Because this is dim. This is hard to work in light right now. It will get dimmer over the course of the night and will be much, much worse to work in. And this brings us, if I'm right, yes, to flash photography. So, flash photography, they're wonderful things. I hate them with a vengeance. In any given typical scene where you and I are standing, where's the light coming from? Light's coming from above. In flash photography, the light comes from the camera. So, if you will, whenever you shoot flash photography, the best way to think about it is, okay, I'm about to shoot a picture where the only light source is going to be a flashlight strapped to the top of the camera. Think of it that way. And then think about what your picture is going to look like. All the shadows will be cast straight back. Okay, that was not me. All the shadows will be cast straight back. The light source will be directly above, beside, or below the lens. This means that all the shadows that we are accustomed to, from the brims of our hats, from the concave of our eyes, all of those, boom, flat relief. I like describing it as it looks an awful lot like somebody got smashed through a cement roller, because that's what all the pictures look like after you shoot flash on them. All of the shadows that we use to describe depth or see depth aren't there. As an added bonus, it also turns the color temperature up, which I haven't talked about at all. Color temperature is one of the wonderful things that the human eye ignores, but digital imaging can't. Color temperature is what we see as the white point in a picture. This is actually, let's stare at these lights. These are white, we say. They're in fact quite yellow. But if you stare at, say, the screen off your laptop, the light coming off it is very blue. These things disappear to the human eye because we have this wonderful thing called the brain, and it processes the images for us and hides all of these little pesky details that we'd rather not deal with. The flash that is common with cameras is a very high color temperature and will come out looking very blue. So if you go back and look at a photo shot in this room of all of your smiling faces right now, and I used flash, it will look wrong. It will look like we were all under fluorescent lights, when in fact we were under an incandescent. Simple advice, don't use flash. So here's how you're gonna do it. Sometimes you don't get a choice. Sometimes your camera doesn't have a high enough ISO setting. Sometimes your camera can't open its aperture up enough. Sometimes you can't hold the camera still for the 3 seconds that you need to collect enough light to get the image. Sometimes you want a low light environment like this one, and you want to freeze fast action, like somebody flinging something across the room, and you just want to get it leaving their hand as opposed to blur. That's a time for flash. Sometimes you need to see the detail of the object you're looking at. If I'm taking pictures of a circuit board that I'm going to be dissecting via looking at the image and figuring out what the chips are on it and how they're arranged, I don't care that it doesn't look like the lighting environment it was shot in. I want to be able to read the numbers on the board. Flash is perfectly acceptable. Social cue. Believe it or not, I had pointed my camera at a group who wanted their photo taken, shot their photo, and walked away, and they got pissed at me. They didn't see a flash fire. They thought I was ignoring them. So, in this case, if you're doing something like that, my advice is to take 2 pictures. Stand there, take a picture of them without flash, then pop your flash up, and shoot the same picture again with the flash, and they'll say, "Oh, thank you," because they will now have known that you actually took their picture. It works. I don't understand why. If you're going to use your flash, and I recommend everybody does on occasion, go out and shoot a whole lot of pictures with it and without it to find out how it will work. Flashes are only effective out to a certain range for certain settings on your camera, specifically ISO. The flash that came on my camera is only good to about 15 foot on ISO 100, but it's good all the way out to 75 foot at ISO 1600. Yes, you're looking at me like I'm out of my mind. I will show you the manual if you don't believe me. I'll show you the pictures if you don't believe me. Bright white splotch. That's it. See the picture of Colonel in the program for an example.
The other problem with the flash is that 1/R².
Yeah, exactly the problem, which is why if you're shooting with flash that's on board, you need to figure out what the ISO setting is for the distance you're working at. And you will find that you will, for what seems like normal distances where you'd be using a very high ISO for a low light environment, you have to turn your ISO down to 100 to get the flash to work right, to get an image that doesn't suck, for lack of a better term. If you're going to regularly use flash, almost every camera, even the little tiny ones that are that big, come with a hot shoe on the top which you can strap a flash onto. Yes, this means that you'll end up using a flash that's perhaps four times the size of your camera. But if you're shooting flash regularly, it's worth it. I use a 30-year-old flash that's external to my camera if I'm doing actual flash photography work. 30-year-old flashes still work, and they still sync with the same cables that exist today. Okay, now we get to the very short artistic section of today's program, because I know squat about doing this. Rule of thirds, stare through your viewfinder, draw a line third of the way vertically, third of the way horizontally. Put your subject at one of the intersections. It looks better. Don't ask me why. I don't understand. It works. I'm dead serious. But it... Other thing to remember, you can always crop the image down. You can never get more context around the subject. Shoot a picture. You're always going to be able to say, okay, I don't want this edge, and throw it away. But you're never going to get more context. Oh, crap, I wanted to see the house he was standing next to. You're not going to get it. You get one shot at pictures. So you got to actually collect what you need that one shot. Because unless you happen to be a major motion picture studio, you can't recreate reality at a whim's notice. The other thing I know a lot of people like to do is take a picture that's square on with their subject. Everybody looks like they're having their mug shot taken when you do this. The trick is to take a picture off center to the subject, because we look at people and we don't see them square onto their face all the time. But when you shoot a picture of somebody and they're looking at you, it comes up square and you see them dead and it looks like there's a mug shot photo going on here. Best trick I've come up with: if I want a picture of somebody and they don't know it yet and they're looking somewhere else, yell their name and shoot the picture as they're turning to look at you. It works. Pits are cheap. Use lots. Really, pits are recyclable. If you don't like the picture you shot, throw it away, take another. In fact, better action, shoot a lot of pictures and then throw away the ones you don't like. This is what I do. If you have a camera that immediately will feedback, give you immediate feedback as to what the picture you just shot was, set it up to do this. Point it at a subject, shoot the picture, look down at it, see if you actually liked the result. If you didn't, don't immediately delete it, even though that's what you feel the need to do. Don't delete it immediately. This may in fact be the best shot you're going to get. You don't know. If you don't like the image, stand up, shoot another. Change your settings a bit, shoot another image. If you're like me, or even with any of the modern cameras, Bunsen, you know this, how much can I get half a gig of flash for now?
A couple of months ago, it was about $60 after
eBay. Yeah, okay, $60. Okay, you can get a gig of flash for $60. For me, a gig of flash is 400 pictures at one step below RAW, as in fine JPEG massive. That's 400 pictures. I can sit there and I can shoot all day and not delete a thing. And this way you don't throw away the one good image that actually you wanted because you didn't think it was good, and then the situation went away. Shoot the same thing again from a different angle. Shoot your object. Step this far. Do it again. Sometimes it's that much of a difference, and you won't notice it until, and you can't see it on the back of the screen. You won't notice it until you load it in your photo editing software, whatever your choice is, and look at it and say, wow, that picture was crap. I wonder what this other one was. And you'll find out, hey, this picture was crap too, but it's lesser crap. So it's the one you'll end up using because you can't get that subject back again. Post-processing. Shoot a lot of photos. Download them to your computer, look through them, look for the ones you want. I have stacks of photos of the exact same scene, exact same thing, 18 photos from the same angle within a huge array of different settings on it. This is because the difference between an okay photo and a good photo and a great photo is usually so minor you wouldn't believe it. So just shoot a lot. Oh yeah, wonderful statistic. I want you to take a guess at how many out of a roll of 36 photos professionals end up having of great shots. 36 photos. I'm getting a 0, I'm getting a 1, I'm getting a 2.
45.
Anybody else want to venture a guess? 1. Shoot 36 pictures, get 1 that they're willing to publish, the rest of them go into the filer, into the garbage can. You aren't going to do any better. I usually do about 1 in 50 that I'm really happy with, 1 in 10 that I put on the web for my friends to stare at and point and laugh. You aren't going to do any better than professionals in this. It's mostly luck. Shoot a whole lot of pictures. Okay. I have no idea how much time I've burnt. I've burnt a half hour. This means there's plenty of time for you to heckle me or ask me questions. But first, next presentation will be tomorrow, 4 p.m., right here. I'm not giving it. So if you're tired of listening to me, don't worry, you don't have to listen to me again. This will be given by Jim Tantalo. He's going to go into the deeper and more strange aspects of how digital cameras actually work and some of the wonderful things you can do post-processing images, including digital darkroom techniques, EXIF headers for pulling out metadata from your images, and, well, focal length, choosing lenses. Frankly, I haven't seen his talk. It should be interesting, even for me. Okay, at this point, I'm going to stop talking and ask you guys to ask me questions. I have a question.
Mm-hmm. And that's how I know about the relationship of F-stops to light. And of course, the bug is printing light or screen printing of the steps of the screen. And there are a lot of techniques for getting good results to reproduce them. And I seem to remember that there are different shapes, and it's getting sort of necessary. Are there different shapes of, you know, when the shutter opens, sometimes that shape of that iris.
Okay.
Okay.
I can describe it this way. For the type of cameras that I'm willing to purchase, it does not matter. That said, yes, it actually is a problem. Most irises are based off 6 to 10 rounded sheets that slide in and out from each other, and thus you get not perfectly round holes. Sometimes they can have rather abrupt edges on them. And if you're shooting objects, or if your image, the imaging surface on your average digital camera is half inch by half inch. The imaging surface on my camera is an inch by an inch, maybe a little more. The imaging surfaces you're talking about are as tall as I am and as wide as I am. There's a little bit difference of scale involved there, a little bit. I would only claim one or two orders of magnitude. And thus, some of the things that will affect that sort of printing, and that sort of camera photography just don't apply in this context. You're right, there is an issue there. This is introduction. I'm trying to avoid getting into the very, very strange aspects of how light works.
And I love that, but I still don't understand studio marketing because I only understand the little marketing. And I was thinking that with digital camera, it might be possible to, do so many photos in so many settings.
Yep. In fact, I encourage everybody to go out, grab your digital camera, find its manual, the one that you threw in, away into the garbage can, go to the manufacturer's website, pull the manual, go read it. It has lots of useful information in there, and in fact covers everything I covered here in much greater detail, and will tell you how to fly the controls on your camera so that you stand a chance of getting the image you want as opposed to what the camera is going to give you. Studio photography, I know nothing about. None. I don't have a studio. I shoot out in the real world. This means everything I've ever been taught about studio photography doesn't apply to me, unless I ignore it. There's my problem and not my problem in my universe, and that falls under the category, not my problem. Sorry. Go for it.
I got sort of a rude awakening this semester at school because I'm a graphic designer, so I've not bought a digital camera last semester. But, it's one of those ones that you can find usually in the office space. So it's, 5 megapixels, it's like a quite a easy shoot. I was told by my professor, and actually several students in my class who are photo majors, so they just take the kids on classes, that's sort of crap in order to get really good photos.
Yep. I can tell you why right now. It's if that's where you're going with this question.
Yeah.
Okay. It's all about capture of light. If your camera is physically this big, you can't put a big lens on the front. The bigger the lens you have, the more light you can capture. The bigger the lens you have, the lower f-stop you can get to. This means that you can do the depth of field effects, which is what everybody loves to see in photography, for reasonably good reasons. It's a neat trick, and it does things that your eye doesn't do. Actually, more precisely, it replicates what your eye does do, which is to say, you can only see at one depth, so it's unnatural to us to look at a photograph that's clear at all depths. So the depth of field effect is something that your eye is doing and is covering up because it adjusts so fast. Unless, of course, you've made it to the point where your vision has trouble adjusting anymore, and that usually hits an old age. But I haven't made it there yet. Okay. So the camera you picked up is 5 megapixel.
Yeah.
This is to say it has 5 million points where it can sample the light on its image sensor. However, its lens is that big.
Yeah.
It has an effective f-stop of somewhere about f22. Period. New line. Enter. That's it. And it's probably not adjustable. And thus it has to shoot the flash whenever it gets dark. And it can't run the gain up any further on the ISO setting. Exactly. This is why SLRs are recommended if you're getting serious about shooting photography. Yes, they're an expensive first step, but they're down to $1,000 with the basic lens. And when you realize why you want another lens, you find a way, you have an actual camera that still works, and you can put a different lens on the front of it, you're already familiar with it, you're comfortable with it, and you can go ahead and move up. Because, like I said, Gabe, who's just in here, he and I have the same camera body. He spent about 3 times the amount of money in lenses that I have, probably more. Same camera body. Entirely different functionality out of the camera because you were able to change out the optics on the front. And added bonus with an SLR, you purchase the optics once and there's a solid chance that they will be the optics you have for the rest of your life, and the imaging sensor in the body will change over time. Right now, I can go out and get the next revision of my camera with an extra 50% imaging pixels on it, faster, better, and I can still use all of my lenses that I already have, and it will perform better than what I have right now, and I'll be familiar with all the gear I have.
Would you recommend a digital SLR or
a... This is a pain. Camera selection when it comes to SLRs, in my mind, this is purely personal opinion, nobody pays me for this, this is me. You have two choices, Nikon, Canon. That's it. Look around, talk to your friends. If you have photography friends who are willing to loan you their lenses, one, you have some of the best friends on the planet. Two, you might want to consider following them if you're still unsure about this and get whatever system they're, get the entry-level model of whatever system they're using so that you can go beg them to borrow a lens so you can try it, so you can find out if you want to buy your own. This is how I made it to Canon. I have a friend who has Canon hardware. He handed me his camera. I looked at it and I said, cool! And I went out and got the appropriate gear to interface with his lenses. So now I can go when I need a lens that I don't own. I can say, can I borrow your lens? And usually it's, yeah, okay. Works out really well. If you're looking to get into it at the low end and you need to get a feel for it, the Canon Digital Rebel is a wonderful camera to get starting on. It's logically equivalent to the 10D without the magnesium case, which means you can't drop kick it. Don't drop kick your camera. In fact, protect your camera. Your camera will outlive you in usefulness. A given shutter is good for 100,000 shots. I'm through 15,000 of them right now. And your lenses will last you the rest of your life. Okay, I'm rambling. Somebody asked me a different question. Did I put you all to sleep? I must have put you all to sleep. I've got two questions in this whole audience and I didn't cover anything. Excellent. Yes.
Is any of these cameras working on the same mount that they used to have on the old 35mm cameras?
You can get adapters. I don't know of any existing cameras that natively do C-mount. The reason for that is, depending on the lens model you go with and how it's set up, almost all all of the cameras are doing digital communications into the lenses to pick up interesting data and useful stuff, like, for example, Canon. The focusing and the aperture are dealt with inside the lens, but they are controlled by the camera body. So it actually has a digital communications path between the camera body and the lens to control those. And in the same sense, the camera body can ask the lens, what's your zoom to? And the lens will communicate back to the camera body, my zoom is X millimeters out. So it can actually, all of this data, thanks to the wonders of digital photography and the EXIF file format, can get captured into your file format, and you can pull this out later for metadata and post-analysis, so you can flip through your stack of pictures and say, that was the one I liked. What were its settings? And you can pull the settings back out of the photo and say, okay, if I'm in this situation again, and I'm staring at the setup, these are the sort of settings I need to go towards. Great feedback tool, because the old method was film, load it in the camera, shoot a picture, flip the camera up, check your settings, write them down, change the setting, point it, shoot again. Now, shoot, setting change, shoot, setting change, shoot, shoot. Go back through it post-process, take a look at what your settings were, figure out what you actually wanted. Okay. Let's see. Are you talking about something that you can load into the film cartridge of a existing film camera?
An existing film camera. You know, there are enough in cameras in the past, like new cameras, where you can get like a polarized back for it.
Right, right.
New camera. And in the same way, maybe I thought I heard that you could actually, if you have a really nice film camera, you can get a digital back.
A lot of people have talked about it. I think some were done at the very early stages of digital photography. I don't know of any existing device along those lines being created for the simple reason that the digital hardware to process all of this stuff is so vastly different than the interior mechanics of the film camera that it's hard to fit all the pieces into an existing film camera. Added bonus, if you actually get a digital body for your existing film lenses, the digital body will be lighter and smaller. Well, that's a lie. The digital body will be differently shaped than your existing film camera because there's no roll of film in one side of it anymore. Warning to anybody who's handled film cameras. No, there is no left side of my camera. It's not there. It's because there's no film here. There's no need for it there, so it simply doesn't exist. The upside is I use such enormous lenses that my left hand is always on the lens. Round two.
That's a very stupid question, but you know, I use the tripod, which that's probably a necessity for most pictures that you're taking.
Yes. I don't use a tripod at all. I own one. Actually, that's a lie. My sister owns one. She lends it to me because she never uses it. It lives in my truck. When I get desperate, I pull it out. This is because the pictures I take are pictures I find in my daily wanderings, and I don't load up to go out and take pictures. I just take pictures with me all the time, which means anything beyond one lens, one body, is too much gear for me to lug. Because at the same time I'm lugging the laptop, books, papers, power adapters, accessories, all this other crap, I'm pretty sure I can get a full loadout for my daily job somewhere around 40 pounds. Because of course, then I have to carry all, I carry my camera during my day job because this is when I run into a lot of my pictures. Okay, I got 20 pounds of crap to do my job and the 20 pounds of crap to do the fun at the same time. It can get rather heavy and I don't have time to use the tripod. That said, if you want to do long exposures, particularly long night exposures, get a tripod, learn how to use it, because it can take care of the issues that shaky hands create. Okay, somebody stand up with a question. Comment, witty remark. Everybody's shaking their heads and staring at me blankly.
This is good stuff.
This is good stuff?
For me.
Okay. Does aperture make sense to everyone? Does it have a basic understanding of what you end up with doing? Does ISO and what it ends up doing make sense? Shutter speed. Everybody got these three things. If you got those three things, I have in fact won, as far as I'm concerned, in this talk. Because that was the part I wanted to get across. Because with those three, you stand a chance at actually pulling off the picture you want.
You're talking about camera brands. You said go either with Canon or Nikon. Is it because you know or heard bad experiences with other brands, or you just know that those are good?
I know that those are good. I have friends who run both variants of hardware. I have friends who have both variants of lenses. Nikon and Canon have both been around for an incredibly long time. Their existing film line of cameras still exist, and they still build them, and they still sell them. In fact, you can pick them up cheap, which means that you can go get a, wander over to eBay and buy a film kit from somebody and swap out one component, or not swap out, add one component, a digital body to it. And now you have a camera that, back up. I went to digital photography for one reason. It was cheaper. After 5,000 pictures, it was cheaper for me to buy the digital body than it was for me to process film. I broke that line a long time ago. Do the math, figure out what film processing runs you, and then ask yourself. Good point. If you're going to be hunting camera gear, you're going to be wanting to find camera gear that's compatible with the standard that's been around for a while and will continue to be around for a while. Because if you start down one path, you're going to buy a lens and a camera. And then in 3 years, megapixel NV will get you, and you'll go buy another body. And then you'll realize the one lens you have doesn't do it for when you want to go out and chase birds around, which I've done. Which is why I ended up with this thing, which is a 300 millimeter lens. Yes, I can read license plates at 400 yards with this. My guys at my office didn't believe me, so I walked out to the window and shot a license plate at 400 yards and showed it to them. They said, "You're crazy, man." Wonderful for chasing wildlife if you like hunting deer but without a rifle. Works great. And then you'll find out that these lenses don't work because these were the first two lenses I bought. Next lens I bought was a 50 millimeter f1.8 because I wasn't able to do portrait shots and I wasn't able to work in the dark, where dark is anything after the sun sets and you're out in the city. That's dark. You don't notice it because your eyes are doing wonderful things. Your eyes are incredibly effective at hiding the details of what the environment actually looks like. Okay, according to the watch in front of me, I have 2 minutes to burn. Colonel, of course, says I have 10, which means I can go on longer. Anything else?
One quick one. First off, I'm gonna throw down my loving script.
Okay, excellent, we have one vote for Canon. Would anyone like to vote for Nikon? We don't have KK here, so he can't vote for it. Okay, we have two votes.
Three for the camera. However, if you're not really willing to drop a grand on an SLR, although you're morally opposed to it, can you recommend anything in the lower end brands, or is it still Canon? In the $300-$400 home consumer.
In the $300-$400 home consumer range. If I'm going down that path, what I tend to do is I tend to look for something from Canon or from Nikon because they tend to have interface coherency between their brands. This way, first thing is I wander into the store and start looking for the camera with the biggest front end lens on it in the price range I'm willing to pay. Particularly if you can't swap the lenses out, that's the lens you're going to be stuck with. And if you can't get an aperture opening on it, you're not going to get portrait shots. Real close. Then look at your imaging sensor. Determine if that's going to be enough megapixels for you. I'm not going into the esoteric details of how megapixels are actually calculated and what they actually do. You can harass me later if you actually are interested in the shell game that are megapixels. Look at the lens. I choose Canon or Nikon because then you're familiar with the control interface, which will be nearly identical when you pop up, when you finally make it to something bigger because you've decided you want to go down that road, and you won't regret it because you'll still be able to get spare parts if you don't go down that road. Look at the lens, look at the imaging sensor, and finally, look at the media it uses to store your image. I am a big fan of compact flash. It's cheap. You can get it in flash or you can get IBM micro drives. You can load a gig into the side of your camera and you can shoot pictures all day, not delete a single one, and then, like I said, go back that next day, look through them, find the ones you want. Don't delete in the field, delete at your computer. That answer your question? Excellent.
Also, I had a $300 mic.
Yes. They typically are because they're typically built by the same engineers.
And it's because they have a big one.
Yep. Believe it or not, lens size matters. It's a big deal, and that's one of the biggest things if you aren't going to be able to swap your lens. Okay. I want to thank you all for sitting through me ad-libbing this for the last half hour. I want to thank you more for sitting through my prepared talk. And if you want to hunt me down, I'll be floating around in the network room shortly.